Chapter 10. Who in his youth had eaten roast dog in the depths of a gloomy forest of snow-loaded pines. My memory cannot place him in any remembered scene. A hooked nose, some sleek white hair, an unrelated evanescent impression of a meager, slight, rigid figure militarily buttoned up to the throat, is all that now exists on earth of Mr. Nicholas B. Only this vague shadow pursued by the memory of his grandnephew, the last surviving human being, I suppose, of all those he had seen in the course of his taciturn life. But I remember well the day of our departure back to exile. The elongated, bizarre, shabby traveling carriage with four-post horses, standing before the long front of the house with its eight columns, four on each side of the broad flight of stairs. On the steps, groups of servants, a few relations, one or two friends from the nearest neighborhood, a perfect silence, on all the faces an air of sober concentration. My grandmother, all in black, gazing stoically. My uncle giving his arm to my mother down to the carriage in which I had been placed already. At the top of the flight my little cousin in a short skirt of a tartan pattern with a deal of red in it, and like a small princess attended by the women of her own household, the head governante, our dear, corpulent Francesca who had been for 30 years in the service of the B family, the former nurse, now outdoor attendant, a handsome peasant face wearing a compassionate expression, and the good, ugly Mlie Durand, the governess, with her black eyebrows meeting over a short, thick nose, and a complexion like pale brown paper. Of all the eyes turned toward the carriage, her good-natured eyes only were dropping tears, and it was her sobbing voice alone that broke the silence with an appeal to me colon nobly posthum francais, mon cheri. In 3 months, simply by playing with us, as he had taught me, not only to speak French, but to read it as well. She was indeed an excellent playmate. In the distance, halfway down to the great gates, a light, open trap, harnessed with three horses in Russian fashion, stood drawn up on one side, with the police captain of the district sitting in it, the visor of his flat cap with a red band pulled down over his eyes. It seems strange that he should have been there to watch our going so carefully. Without wishing to treat with levity the just timidites of imperialists all the world over, I may allow myself the reflection that a woman, practically condemned by the doctors, and a small boy not quite 6 years old, could not be regarded as seriously dangerous, even for the largest of conceivable empires saddled with the most sacred of responsibilities. And this good man, I believe, did not think so either. I learned afterward why he was present on that day. I don't remember any outward signs, but it seems that, about a month before, my mother became so unwell that there was a doubt whether she could be made fit to travel in the time. In this uncertainty, the Governor General in Kiev was petitioned to grant her a fortnight's extension of stay in her brother's house. No answer whatever was returned to this prayer, but one day at dusk the police captain of the district drove up to the house and told my uncle's valet, who ran out to meet him, that he wanted to speak with the master in private at once. Very much impressed, he thought it was going to be an arrest. The servant, more dead than alive with fright, as he related afterward, smuggled him through the big drawing room, which was dark. That room was not lighted every evening, on tiptoe, so as not to attract the attention of the ladies in the house, and led him by way of the orangery to my uncle's private apartments. The policeman, without any preliminaries, thrust a paper into my uncle's hands. There, pray read this. I have no business to show this paper to you. It is wrong of me. But I can't either eat or sleep with such a job hanging over me. That police captain, a native of Great Russia, had been for many years serving in the district. My uncle unfolded and read the document. It was a service order issued from the Governor General's Secretariat, D. dealing with the matter of the petition, and directing the police captain to disregard all remonstrances and explanations in regard to that illness either from medical men or others. And if as he has not left her brother's house, it went on to say, and the morning of the day specified on her permit, you are to dispatch her at once under escort, direct, underlined, O the prison hospital in Kiev, where she will be treated as her case demands. For God's sake, Mr. B, see that your sister goes away punctually on that day. Don't give me this work to do with a woman, and with one of your family too. I simply cannot bear to think of it. He was absolutely wringing his hands. My uncle looked at him in silence. Thank you for this warning. I assure you, that even if she were dying she would be carried out to the carriage. Yes indeed, and what difference would it make travel to Kiev or back to her husband? For she would have to go death or no death. And mind, Mr. B, I will be here on the day, not that I doubt your promise, but because I must. I have got to. Duty. All the same, my trade is not fit for a dog, since some of you Poles will persist in rebelling, and all of you have got to suffer for it. This is the reason why he was there in an open three-horse trap pulled up between the house and the great gates. I regret not being able to give up his name to the scorn of all believers in the right of conquest, as a reprehensibly sensitive guardian of imperial greatness. On the other hand, I am in a position to state the name of the Governor General who signed the order with the marginal note to be carried out to the letter in his own handwriting. The gentleman's name was Bezak. A high dignitary, an energetic official, the idol for a time of the Russian patriotic press. Each generation has its memories. IV, it must not be supposed that, in setting forth the memories of this half hour between the moment my uncle left my room till we met again at dinner, I am losing sight of Lemaire's folly. Having confessed that my first novel was begun in idleness, a holiday task, I think I have also given the impression that it was a much delayed book. It was never dismissed from my mind, even when the hope of ever finishing it was very faint. Many things came in its way. Daily duties, new impressions, old memories. It was not the outcome of a need, the famous need of self-expression which artists find in their search for motives. The necessity which impelled me was a hidden, obscure necessity, a completely unmasked and unaccountable phenomenon. Or perhaps some idle and frivolous magician, there must be magicians in London, had cast a spell over me through his parlor window as I explored the maze of streets east and west in solitary leisurely walks without chart and compass. Till I began to write that novel I had written nothing but letters, and not very many of these. I never made a note of a fact, of an impression, or of an anecdote in my life. The conception of a planned book was entirely outside my mental range when I sat down to write. The ambition of being an author had never turned up among those gracious imaginary existences one creates fondly for oneself at times, in the stillness and immobility of a daydream. Yet it stands clear as the sun at noonday, that from the moment I had done blackening over the first manuscript page of Lemaire's Folly, it contained about 200 words, and this proportion of words to a page has remained with me through the 15 years of my writing life. From the moment I had, in the simplicity of my heart, and the amazing ignorance of my mind, written that page, the die was cast. Never had Rubicon been more blindly forded without invocation to the gods, without fear of men. That morning I got up from my breakfast, pushing the chair back, and rang the bell violently, or perhaps I should say resolutely, or perhaps I should say eagerly, I do not know. But manifestly it must have been a special ring of the bell, a common sound made impressive, like the ringing of a bell for the raising of the curtain upon a new scene. It was an unusual thing for me to do. Generally, I dawdled over my breakfast, and I seldom took the trouble to ring the bell for the table to be cleared away. But on that morning, for some reason hidden in the general mysteriousness of the event, I did not dawdle. And yet I was not in a hurry. I pulled the cord casually, and while the faint tinkling somewhere down in the basement went on, I charged my pipe in the usual way and I looked for the matchbox with glances distraught indeed, but exhibiting, I am ready to swear, no signs of a fine frenzy. I was composed enough to perceive after some considerable time the matchbox lying there on the mantelpiece right under my nose. And all this was beautifully and safely usual. Before I had thrown down the match, my landlady's daughter appeared with her calm, pale face and an inquisitive look in the doorway. Of late it was the landlady's daughter who answered my bell. I mention this little fact with pride, because it proves that during the 30 or 40 days of my tenancy I had produced a favorable impression. For a fortnight past I had been spared the unattractive sight of the domestic slave. The girls in that Bessborough Gardens house were often changed, but whether short or long, fair or dark, they were always untidy and particularly bedraggled, as if in a sordid version of the fairy tale the Ashpin cat had been changed into a maid. I was infinitely sensible of the privilege of being waited on by my landlady's daughter. She was neat ephonemic. Will you please clear away all this at once? I addressed her in convulsive accents, being at the same time engaged in getting my pipe to draw. This, I admit, was an unusual request. Generally, on getting up from breakfast I would sit down in the window with a book, and let them clear the table when they liked. But if you think that on that morning I was in the least impatient, you are mistaken. I remember that I was perfectly calm. As a matter of fact, I was not at all certain that I wanted to write, or that I meant to write, or that I had anything to write about. No, I was not impatient. I lounged between the mantelpiece and the window, not even consciously waiting for the table to be cleared. It was 10 to 1 that before my landlady's daughter was done I would pick up a book and sit down with it all the morning in a spirit of enjoyable indolence. I affirm it with assurance, and I don't even know now what were the books then lying about the room. Whatever they were not the works of great masters, where the secret of clear thought and exact expression can be found. Since the age of 5 I have been a great reader, as is not perhaps wonderful in a child who was never aware of learning to read. At 10 years of age I had read much of Victor Hugo and other romantics. I had read in Polish and in French, history, voyages, novels. I knew Il Blas and Don Quixote in abridged editions. I had read in early boyhood Polish poets and some French poets, but I cannot say what I read on the evening before I began to write myself. I believe it was a novel, and it is quite possible that it was one of Anthony Trollope's novels. It is very likely. My acquaintance with him was then very recent. He is one of the English novelists whose works I read for the first time in English. With men of European reputation, with Dickens and Walter Scott and Thackeray, it was otherwise. My first introduction to English imaginative literature was Achola's Nickleby. It is extraordinary how well Mrs. Nickleby could chatter disconnectedly in Polish, and the sinister Ralph Rage in that language. As to the Crummles family and the family of the learned Squeers, it seemed as natural to them as their native speech. It was, I have no doubt, an excellent translation. This must have been in the year 70. But I really believe that I am wrong. That book was not my first introduction to English literature. My first acquaintance was the Woe Gentleman of Verona, and that in the very MS of my father's translation. It was during our exile in Russia, and it must have been less than a year after my mother's death, because I remember myself in the black blouse with a white border of my heavy mourning. We were living together, quite alone, in a small house on the outskirts of the town of T that afternoon, instead of going out to play in the large yard which we shared with our landlord. I had lingered in the room in which my father generally wrote. What emboldened me to clamber into his chair I am sure I don't know, but a couple of hours afterward he discovered me kneeling in it with my elbows on the table, and my head held in both hands over the MS of loose pages. I was greatly confused, expecting to get into trouble. He stood in the doorway looking at me with some surprise, but the only thing he said after a moment of silence was, "Read the page aloud." Luckily, the page lying before me was not overblotted with erasures and corrections, and my father's handwriting was otherwise extremely legible. When I got to the end, he nodded, and I flew out of doors, thinking myself lucky to have escaped reproof for that piece of impulsive audacity. I have tried to discover since the reason for this mildness, and I imagine that all unknown to myself I had earned, in my father's mind, the right to some latitude in my relations with his writing table. It was only a month before, or perhaps it was only a week before, that I had read to him aloud from beginning to end, and to his perfect satisfaction, as he lay on his bed, not being very well at the time, the proofs of his translation of Victor Hugo's Toilers of the Sea. Such was my title to consideration, I believe, and also my first introduction to the sea in literature. If I do not remember where, how, and when I learned to read, I am not likely to forget the process of being trained in the art of reading aloud. My poor father, an admirable reader himself, was the most exacting of masters. I reflect proudly that I must have read that page of Woe Gentleman of Verona tolerably well at the age of 8. The next time I met them was in A5's. One-volume edition of the dramatic works of William Shakespeare, read in Falmouth, at odd moments of the day, to the noisy accompaniment of Cocker's mallets driving oakum into the deck seams of a ship in dry dock. We had run in a sinking condition, and with the crew refusing duty after a month of weary battling with the gales of the North Atlantic. Books are an integral part of one's life, and my Shakespearean associations are with that first year of our bereavement, the last I spent with my father in exile. He sent me away to Poland to my mother's brother directly he could brace himself up for the separation, and with the year of hard gales, the year in which I came nearest to death at sea, first by water, and then by fire. Those things I remember, but what I was reading the day before my writing life began I have forgotten. I have only a vague notion that it might have been one of Trollope's political novels. And I remember, too, the character of the day. It was an autumn day with an opaline atmosphere, a veiled, semi-opaque, lustrous day, with fiery points and flashes of red sunlight on the roofs and windows opposite, while the trees of the square, with all their leaves gone, were like the tracings of India ink on a sheet of tissue paper. It was one of those London days that have the charm of mysterious amenity, of fascinating softness. The effect of opaline mist was often repeated at Bessborough Gardens on account of the nearness to the river. There is no reason why I should remember that effect more on that day than on any other day, except that I stood for a long time looking out of the window after the landlady's daughter was gone with her spoil of cups and saucers. I heard her put the tray down in the passage and finally shut the door, and still I remained smoking, with my back to the room. It is very clear that I was in no haste to take the plunge into my writing life, if as plunge this first attempt may be described. My whole being was steeped deep in the indolence of a sailor away from the sea, the scene of never-ending labor and of unceasing duty. For utter surrender to an indolence you cannot meet a sailor ashore when that mood is on him, the mood of absolute irresponsibility tasted to the full. It seems to me that I thought of nothing. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.